It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The lawsuit by a transgender woman against the Allegheny County Jail is proceeding. She alleges she was sexually assaulted multiple times when she was placed in a cell with a male prisoner. Also, the cold is closing schools, but it also seems to have a chilling effect on various activities in the Pittsburgh area. That's later in the show. But first, state officials are calling for two current state lawmakers to resign. A former state senator quit his post as state fire commissioner over the weekend, and the Senate security officer left late last week. The number of allegations of sexual harassment and misconduct in state government seems to be growing. We're going to address that and what steps are being taken to discourage these actions. On the line from Harrisburg is Paula Knudsen, investigative reporter for The Caucus, the weekly print-only newspaper covering state government and politics. The Caucus celebrated its first anniversary this week. Paula, welcome and congratulations.
Hey, thanks for having me on the show.
And also joining us from Harrisburg is Mark Scolfaro, who covers state government for the Associated Press in Harrisburg. Mark, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
As always, your participation is encouraged. Tweet your comments and questions to us and use the hashtag WESAConfluence. Paula, I want to start with you. You've been researching and covering this issue for the past year. Let me start with what spurred your interest many months before, shall we say, the dam broke on so many allegations of sexual harassment in state government coming through?
Well, our bureau chief here is Brad Bumstead, as some folks in your area may know him from the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. So we started, as you said, a year ago. And when we were, you know, looking at issues that we were interested in, the issue of gender came up. It's something that here in Harrisburg, most people know Pennsylvania is one of the states that has very low representation of women in the legislature. It's something that's immediately apparent when you walk around the halls. And so we wondered, how did that play out? How did that play out in state agencies where there are sexual harassment issues? So we began our Right to Know requests on this topic a year ago. And we've been plugging away, but I'm sure, as Mark will talk about, the reporting on this is not easy. The information is often secret, and it's hard to get at.
Well, Mark, I use the term so many allegations. I'd like you to follow up what Paula said. But this week, you and the Associated Press published reports about sexual misconduct allegations detailed in information that you received through a Right to Know request from the Wolf administration. So how difficult was it to get the information you got? Did you get what you needed?
Well, to the extent that we got what they provided, that wasn't difficult. But I would say it's accurate to characterize it as an ongoing process. For example, the administration has been able to provide sort of some numbers, agency by agency, about the numbers of allegations. But there's not much meat on those bones when it comes down to it. They're just raw numbers. And one of the questions I think a lot of people have is, how much does this cost? What kind of settlements have occurred? And those questions, I think, in my mind, came to the forefront, I believe it was in November, when reports emerged out of Congress in Washington that they had made settlements involving members. So in an attempt to figure out the lay of the land, I'm seeking that information. But even in providing the detail the administration has so far, they've said they've told me that the process of trying to get their arms around settlements in the, you know, large state government is ongoing. So there's definitely more to know, and hopefully more documents, more facts coming out that will shed light on what's been happening.
All right, Mark. So your reporting said that the state government agencies fielded 339 reports of alleged sexual harassment over a recent five-year period. This to both of you. Are you surprised by that number in any way? Did it shock you, or say, no, I've been sort of hearing about this, at least anecdotally? Paul, let's start with you, then Mark.
Well, the number, you know, I think one of our stories we did in last month, we talked to the victim advocate for the state, Jennifer Storm. And one of the things that I thought, you know, ties in with how many numbers are reported is something she said. Oftentimes, people don't report this. It's just something that there's still a lot of stigma and shame about, particularly when you're talking about sexual harassment that's gone into actual sexual assault, unwanted touching, and other criminal activity. So, you know, is this the tip of the iceberg? Are these numbers underreported? I think we just don't know. Mark, I'm interested to hear what you have to say on that.
Yeah, I mean, I think the administration wanted to make the point to us that, you know, this is in the context of an enormous state workforce of 73,000 people, and a raw number doesn't really capture it. I mean, is that a large number or a small number? It's, I mean, one is a large number if it involves you or your family or, you know, I mean, so in that sense, it's a little difficult to say if it's surprising or how really to process that. That's why I think the more reporting about specific cases, about what happened in some of these, you know, what happened to some of these, the specific allegations, or even what people have admitted to, I think are revealing. I mean, a whole lot can fall under the category of alleged sexual harassment, but actually reading about the details in legal documents brings it home that, I mean, it has an undeniable negative impact on the lives of the people, largely women, who are subject to it.
Paula, you reported a cover story for the caucus in December that talked about Harrisburg's culture of silence, excuse me. Would you sum up what you found in this culture of silence?
So Mark mentioned, you know, when the news from Congress started coming out and this Me Too movement was really sweeping across the country, hitting different industries, we started talking to people to say, you know, largely it's been silent here in Pennsylvania, in the state capital. Why is that? And people told us, you know, we conducted a number of interviews with lobbyists, staffers, people who come in and, you know, talk to legislators and legislators themselves. And pretty much the message we got across the board is, yes, there's a problem, but people don't want to speak. And one of the reasons that was offered to us by one young woman was that, you know, there's a fear of retaliation. A different person told us it's the price of doing business in Harrisburg. And what that all means is, there is sexual harassment. There is, you know, a culture of predatory behavior toward particularly young women. And for a long time, it just hasn't bubbled up above the surface. Our lead comment came from a woman lobbyist who's been in Harrisburg for decades. And she said, back in the 70s, 80s, women had a signal that if they asked another woman for a cigarette, that was a clue that they needed help getting away from a man who was being too forward with them, possibly beyond too forward. She said, since those days, she hasn't seen it get much better.
That was Morgan Plant you're referring to?
Right. She's a longtime lobbyist here in Harrisburg.
So this is interesting. Mark, where's the numbers that you got released to the Associated Press talked about? That was over a five-year period. And Paula, the lobbyist, is talking about this has been going on for decades, correct?
That's right. And, you know, we cited some different examples that had happened here in Harrisburg, one involving a senator where there were claims of sexual harassment that was investigated and found to be not enough there to move forward. But that was in the 90s, I think. So, I mean, these issues have come up, but just not to the extent of the coverage they're getting now.
Mark, the largest number of complaints that you reported on this week ranged from the Corrections Department, I believe, 91, to State Police with 34 over that same time period. What, in your mind, is there more to be gleaned from this information? Let me use this as an example. The number from the Corrections Department, do we know if that was misconduct that was alleged inflicted on inmates, or is it strictly employees versus employees?
No, I'm afraid I don't know that. But one thing to keep in mind is that the Corrections Department is an enormous arm of state government. It's one of the largest in terms of employees, but it stands to reason they've got one of the largest budgets and they operate around the clock. So it's not terribly surprising. It kind of reminds me of seeing news stories about Pennsylvania ranking fifth in some demographic category. Well, it's the fifth most populous state.
Yeah.
I don't know why corrections was at the top of it, but I think that it's also notable in that list that that most agencies have reported something. I mean, there are some that, for example, in the most recent fiscal year, you know, banking had no reports of any kind of harassment. General services had no reports, but a place like DPW, now the Department of Human Services, they had, you know, they had 19 reports, 14 for harassment and 5 for sexual harassment. Well, again, DPW is a large arm of state government, and you'd expect some numbers. I think one good question and something that popped out to me that's going to require some more reporting is why a place like the Liquor Control Board, not a vast agency, would have would have numbers that seem to be out of proportion to their size, the number of employees.
Paula, what did the caucus learn about sexual harassment and misconduct lawsuits and complaints filed against the Pennsylvania State Police?
Well, that was a project that took months to try to gather information. We came up with a total of close to $8 million that was paid out by the state police in settlements alone involving allegations of sexual misconduct, harassment, and in some cases, behavior that included a trooper in uniform in a squad car going to find a woman who he was romantically interested in, another woman who worked for the state police, and handcuffing her to the car. That was a case that settled. So we looked through state and federal records in the Pittsburgh region, the Harrisburg region, the Philly region, and those three federal district courts. And then we filed right-to-know requests with the Attorney General's office to get copies of the settlement agreements, because often the settlement agreements with the amount of money and the terms that would not allow the participants to talk about the cases, they weren't part of the dockets, the court records. So we had to then go and find them to turn up how much money was paid out by the state to settle these cases. That doesn't include verdicts. So at the end of December, there was a verdict on a sexual harassment case out of a federal court in Philadelphia where a female corporal had complained, said she wasn't getting relief from her chain of command about treatment she was receiving by a fellow trooper. The jury found in her favor to the tune of $250,000. So what we reported last month in our parent company, LNP Media, as well as the Philadelphia Inquirer, that was just settlements. So, I mean, the universe of settlements and jury verdicts for all of these agencies, I don't know if we really have a complete picture. And that's why Auditor General Eugene D. Pasquale said he was going to convene his team to start looking at settlements in sexual harassment cases across all state agencies.
It's the confluence where go ahead, Mark.
One thing to point out here is that in some of the documents that have come out already, one of the ways that the costs were covered, and this is for the House Democratic Caucus, was they ended up paying a settlement out of a fund run by the Department of General Services, but then they also paid for their own legal costs out of a special leadership fund. And, people who watch state government closely will probably recall that those special leadership funds have always drawn scrutiny because it's essentially a large pile of money that each of the four caucus leaders has control over, great discretion over how to use it. And so here's a case where, you know, I think some people would look at that and wonder, why would the House Democratic leader be able to just have a special fund that he can cover somebody's, the legal costs related to a misconduct? I mean, they settled the case, so clearly they're acknowledging misconduct. So that gets into I think there are questions about accountability in the process here, too. I think, Paula, I'm sure you'd agree with me. I think that, when we get more details about what state agencies have done, the practices they've followed, in settling these cases, the amount of money that they've paid out, and yes, the confidentiality agreements, which probably are not going to prevent them from becoming public, but you know, are done almost as a, you know, almost automatically put into these agreements. I think all of that will. I think that's all information that's going to be coming out probably soon, and I think that will put a lot more of the detail out there about exactly how this works. And right. You know, the bottom line is that if this behavior is going on inside state government, it means that, you know, first of all, you know, it's wrong, it's illegal, but also, those are employees who aren't doing their jobs when they're engaging in this behavior. And then the taxpayers, having paid them, also get to pay these settlements.
All right. So we are talking about taxpayer dollars. Paul, I want you to chime in. But, of course, one of the references was to Representative Thomas Calderon. A $250,000 settlement was made, and there was a nondisclosure agreement that became revealed. Paul, I wanted to get you to talk a little bit about there are legislative efforts to eliminate nondisclosure agreements and not use taxpayer dollars. What can we expect from these legislative proposals?
That's right. Senator Judy Schwenk, a Democrat from Berks County, right around Thanksgiving, called a press conference, and there were several other Democratic lawmakers along with her at the press conference, where she said, this practice of using nondisclosure agreements has to stop. It allows, you know, bad behavior to continue in secret, and furthermore, you know, taxpayer dollars in government cases are being used. So that legislation that Senator Schwenk has would apply to both state actors as well as private companies. Now, you know, some critics have said that kind of legislation is too broad, that there are problems with it. But her goal, as she mentioned at the press conference, is really to draw attention to this practice that really became highlighted in the national conversation with the Harvey Weinstein case. So her legislation is pending. There's another bill that was introduced by Representative Leanne Kruger-Branicki, a Democrat from Delaware County, that would apply to nondisclosure agreements in the House of Representatives and the legislature.
Okay, we have just a couple minutes left. I want to get to a couple points that two people did resign within the past week. Justin Ferranti resigned as the director of security for the state Senate over allegations he harassed two female subordinates. Then during the last weekend, Pennsylvania Fire Commissioner Tim Solabi abruptly quit. This week, I spoke with Governor Wolf about the resignation of Solabi, whom he appointed as fire commissioner.
I made it clear just as recently as this morning in a staff meeting, I have no tolerance for this. And I don't want anybody to be under any misimpression that there is any small amount of tolerance for this. This is just, no one shall do this. In the executive branch, I have the ability to determine who works for me and who does not. Where my authority extends, I have let it be known that I will not tolerate this, and I will take action against people who violate this norm.
And that includes Mr. Solabi?
I don't make comments on individual personnel matters.
All right. So no comments on individual personnel matters. But do we really expect actions either at the executive level or at the legislative level to address this overall problem? Let's start with Mark, then Paula.
Well, I know the administration says that they are doing an in-depth review of the complaints, you know, the nature of them, how it was handled. I think your listeners can decide for themselves if they think that sounds like the right approach. But, you know, there's no you don't need to look far to see an example of how when this sort of thing surfaces, it can take a life of its own, and then there's a political movement to make change. And I'm thinking of the scandal that was centered at the Attorney General's office and involving some of the Supreme Court justices a few years ago. I mean, I think if there is going to be a movement for legislation, I think whatever the opinions are of the average Pennsylvania voter expressed to their representatives is going to have probably a lot to do with what comes out the other end in terms of actual change.
Paula, briefly.
you know, you asked about the legislature. Will anything move there? Senator Schwenk's bill on non-disclosure agreements includes both Democrats and Republicans. It's in the Senate Judiciary Committee. So, you know, as the legislature gets moving here in the new year, will that legislation move out of the Judiciary Committee? You know, that's a big question mark. But certainly there's increasing pressure as more and more names are revealed and as more scrutiny is being applied. And our news organizations certainly are not the only ones who are filing right-to-knows and are pushing for more disclosure. You know, it would be surprising if more information didn't come out. Let's put it that way.
I think the House said at one in the last couple of weeks that that the House of Representatives alone had 30-some open records requests related to this topic.
All right. Mark Scalfaro covers state government for the Associated Press in Harrisburg. Paula Knutson is investigative reporter for The Caucus, a weekly print-only product of LNP Media. Thanks so much to both of you.
All right. Thanks so much.
My pleasure. Have a wonderful day.
Coming up, we'll get an update on a lawsuit by a transgender woman against the Allegheny County Jail. That's next on The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
What's trending in Pittsburgh? I'm Sarah Kovash. It's so cold that the National Aviary had to move its penguins inside. The African penguins are residing in a warm indoor enclosure. The National Weather Service says today marks the chilliest day of the cold snap, with wind chill making temperatures feel well below zero. And a local family was reunited with its dog after it was snatched by an eagle. The 8-pound Bichon Frise was found several miles away, in rough condition but alive. Find more at WESA.FM.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin.
It was over a period of the next 4 days that Ms. Williams was repeatedly raped by this male inmate. Despite her cries for help, including an electronic communication system that are within the cell.
That's Attorney Alec Wright, who, along with the ACLU, is bringing a federal lawsuit against Allegheny County Jail and its administration. They're claiming officials allowed a transgender inmate, Jules Williams, to be sexually abused by male inmates while she was incarcerated under the incorrect gender identity. We're going to get an update on this case from Ben Schmidt, reporter for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. Ben, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. And as always, your comments and questions are encouraged. Tweet them and use the hashtag WESAConfluence. Ben, let's remind listeners about some of the background in this case. Who is Jules Williams?
So Jules Williams is a Pittsburgher. She's a transgender woman. She was born a male, a boy, and she transitioned as she got into her late teens. And few run-ins with the law. She'd been arrested a few times, and she's alleging in a lawsuit that she was, despite her pleas not to be housed with men, she was, and then she was actually put in a solitary cell with another inmate who raped her repeatedly for 4 days, and that's how I came to meet her.
Those run-ins were prostitution, drug possession, stuff like that?
Correct.
Okay. Now, do we know why she was placed in a cell with a male inmate? Because she did have official documentation, government-issued documentation, birth certificate, and state ID card that listed her as a female.
Well, yeah, and without being too graphic, so she's had some of the transition procedures, but not all of them.
Okay.
So I think somebody who was taking her into the intake procedure said, no, you're a man, this is where you're going, mm-hmm. if that's a good way to explain it.
Okay. Yeah. So has the county explained its reasoning for the placement of Jules Williams in a cell with a man?
Not really. They've said they don't have a comment on a lawsuit. They have said that there's a policy, that there's a transgender board, and this mirrors the states, that would take up each case when there's, you know, a claim like this that the person should not be housed with men. Now, the lawyer that you had on initially, Alec Wright, is saying that that procedure did not take place at all. That's part of the allegation.
On one instance, Williams says she was placed in protective custody while awaiting trial, and a male inmate was placed with her. Jules Williams spoke to WESA and other members of the media when announcing the lawsuit.
And I even call out to him, and he'd be like, do you know I have 200 guys here that I have to answer to, and you know, I can't stop and answer your questions. You're just going to have to grow up and suck it up. And you know what I mean? I was told a lot of times to just suck it up.
All right, Devin, you were respond to that, please. Did that surprise you?
The allegations are horrific. You know, that's my response. If it's true, we don't know the truth yet, but that's what they're alleging.
Okay, yeah. So here's this lawsuit. You covered it as a news story, but what made you want to go farther with this story? Not just the story of the lawsuit, but the story of Jules Williams.
Sure, we were all at that press conference together, and you know, the allegations really struck me, and I just asked the attorney if there's a chance, you know, we could meet one-on-one, and he arranged that. So I spent, I think, two or three sessions with Jules and the attorney, and we had a photographer there as well, and just wanted her to tell me her story, her life story, you know, how she got to this point.
Okay. So your report, while in custody, she appeared in October of 2015 before Judge Thomas Flaherty, via teleconference. And did Judge Flaherty refer to her, recognize her as female?
I don't recall that exactly how that went down.
Okay, but did he order something specific regarding, did he tell the jail to say, okay, treat her like a female or what? Do we know that?
I'm not sure how that exact instance went down.
Okay. Sure, now, she was arrested again in 2016, I believe, and she was housed again with a male inmate. So this was not a one-time thing, housed with male inmates, was it?
It was not. The allegation is it happened several times.
Okay. Now, she has had struggles, including drug addiction and all that. Has she blamed her struggles to fit in for her run-ins with the legal system? What did she say?
A little bit. I mean, she said it's common for a transgender population to succumb to depression and alcohol and drug abuse. So that's definitely been part of her lifestyle and part of the things that she's encountered.
Mm-hmm. So during her most recent incarceration, which was July of 17, I believe, you report a mental health specialist at the jail evaluated Williams and requested in writing that she be transferred to female general population housing. Have you learned out again, or is the county not talking, why that didn't occur?
Yeah, they're not really talking as to why it did not happen.
That's not really a surprise when it comes to lawsuits, though, is it?
It's not. I mean, it's rare that you'll get much, you know, especially from an official entity like the county on a pending lawsuit.
All right, so they wouldn't answer your questions, but have they released any statements? The warden, who is one of the subjects of this suit, or Orlando Harper, have they released any statements?
Well, they did release the statement that said that they have a policy that mirrors the state that the inmate is supposed to appear before a board to determine when they are transgender, whether they should be housed somewhere else. And again, the lawyer is saying that that did not occur.
So the process didn't occur. The evaluation did not occur, or the housing did not occur?
Neither, according to the attorney.
So the attorney is claiming that the so-called process following the state law did not occur.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
Ben, is the jail, from your reporting, considering any policy changes when it comes to transgender inmates?
If they are, we're not aware of it.
And is this a question you keep trying to explore about?
Absolutely.
Okay, you know, this situation, this lawsuit, is it going to trigger a change in policy, or at least a consideration of or a review of policy?
Well, and I think what they've done is give us that statement that I referred to earlier, that we have this policy and it's the same as the state. Whether they're using the policy is the real question.
This is not, we're quickly running out of time, but the attorney, Alec Wright, suggests that this is not necessarily an isolated case, that there have been quite a few transgender inmates in the jail last year.
He does suggest that, and Jules said that she has plenty of friends who are transgender who have been in the jail and had similar not necessarily sexual assault, but been housed with the male population.
Okay. So final question for you, Ben Schmidt. Do we know what the next steps in this suit are? What's next in this case?
Well, you know, as a lawyer would say, that, you know, the next step is discovery, where they're trying to, you know, take evidence and interview people and see where the lawsuit goes. So it'll either head to trial or at some point maybe there'll be a settlement. But it's definitely in its infancy.
Ben Schmitz, a reporter for the Pittsburgh Tribune-Review. Ben, thanks so much as always.
Thanks again.
Coming up on The Confluence, it's cold outside and it's affecting more than schools. Are businesses feeling the chilling impact? That's next on The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, the first NHL Winter Classic is played in Orchard Park, New York in 2008, with the Pittsburgh Penguins defeating the Buffalo Sabres 2-1. It was the first outdoor regular season professional hockey game played in the U.S. More than 71,000 people attended, and the outdoor games have become an annual NHL tradition. That's this week's Pittsburgh Almanac for January 5th, 2018.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin. Here's some news, but it's no surprise to anyone in Western Pennsylvania. It's cold outside. Now, how frigid is it? Well, cold enough to get its own name, Grayson, and earn a couple of interesting emojis. We're going to talk about all that and some updates to the restaurant scene with Hal B. Klein, who covers restaurants and the food scene for Pittsburgh Magazine. Welcome, Hal.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on again.
And Rosalind Culgan is culture writer for The Incline. Good to see you again, Rosalind.
Glad to be here.
And Gretchen McKay, who writes for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Welcome, Gretchen.
Welcome, and thank you.
All righty, and you're welcome to join the conversation. Tweet us your comments or questions using the hashtag WESAConfluence. All right. The cold has closed schools, as I alluded to, delayed the start of classes. Even the National Aviary has so cold, it's moved its penguins indoors because of the cold. Russell, let's start with you. Tell us how Pittsburghers you've talked to are dealing with this icy, frigid weather.
Well, it is certainly desolate downtown. I just drove through there, and I think maybe people packed their lunches today. They probably don't want to get out into Market Square where it's cold. I am not one for cold weather, so I recently wrote a piece about how to cut through public spaces downtown so you can beat the cold, and even saving just a few steps outside really can be helpful.
So these underground tunnels we're talking about to beat the cold, beat the outside?
Yes, some of them. And some of them are cutting through buildings such as the Omni William Penn is my favorite cut through. Not only is it a resplendent place to look at, but you can grab coffee. There's what I like to call Pittsburgh's most beautiful Starbucks there. And you can stay warm and shave off a few steps.
And you can pop downstairs and go into the speakeasy.
Absolutely.
Grab yourself a cocktail.
Okay.
That'll warm you up.
Because we know whiskey is always a good way to ward
right?
off the
bones a little bit.
Sure.
Yeah. So, and you just sort of talk to people, your sources, just because you're curious reporters and writers. What are they telling you about, you know, what they're doing? Are they hunkering down or anything?
Well, let me tell you, I'm a runner, and there are a lot of runners out there in Pittsburgh. And Rosalind, I know you don't like the cold, but
no.
There's plenty of people who do. And in fact, I know for sure that there will be runners out this weekend fighting the cold, even though Pittsburgh Marathon has delayed their kickoff run.
Yeah, they were supposed to do that Saturday.
They're supposed to do it tomorrow, but they're going to now, it's been moved to noon on Sunday when it's going to be a little bit warmer. It'll be in the 20s. So, but, you know, I guess it's just what you're used to. I was just telling Hal and Rosalind as we were sitting out waiting to come on that I grew up in a house where my brothers slept in an unheated third floor. I, for many years, slept in an unheated third floor in my own house. So I don't know. It's cold out there, but
so it's a good opportunity to get cozy, though, right? So a lot of people I know are working through cookbooks that they want to work through, making soup, roasting a chicken. So I think it's a good time for that, right?
Well, that's interesting that you say that. People are maybe checking out the cookbooks or digging in for recipes. And earlier, Russell, you said that people might be packing their lunch rather than going out for a noontime lunch. So this could be, you know, at least anecdotally, hurting the restaurant scene. And, you know, in terms of business, maybe not somebody going out during the daytime at going and buying their lunch at a restaurant or even going out in the evening for dinner.
Yeah, I think that's possible. I think, you know, it's one of those times that when it's so cold out, people might want to stay home. The oven also is an extra heat source, which is kind of nice, right? So, you know, you've got your stove on, you've got your oven on, it keeps the house a little bit warmer. So it could be a tough weekend for restaurants a little bit.
But then again, when it's cold, you get really hungry and you might want to go out and have somebody prepare something that's really hearty for you, like a cassoulet, perhaps.
Yeah.
Something that
is... Good time to go to Legume.
Exactly.
Get something like that, yeah.
So...
Yeah. All right. So if you are at home, Hal, since you brought up this cookbook thing and delving into recipes, well, so whether this is to you, Hal, and all three of you, whether it's at home or in the restaurants around town, any exciting recipes, dishes that you've found for a nice cold winter day?
You know, there seems to be a thing for roast chicken right now. So it's one of the things that I love to make at home. I think there are a couple of restaurants right now. So Floor 2, which just opened up at the Fairmont, has an amazing roast chicken. Vivo in Swickley has this chicken that it's roasted and then fried, so it's crispy, which is delicious. So I think that's, you know, for me, that's something that, like, I think is very exciting right now. And, you know, if you're doing it at home, you can throw some potatoes and carrots and some vegetables underneath it.
You're
a terrific home cook,
Gretchen. I have chicken soup on my stove right now, so that's cooking away.
Rosalyn?
As for cocktails, it's also a really great time of year for a hot cocktail. Speaking of Floor 2, if you want to pair something with your roast chicken, they have a drink called the Chai Warm Up, which is really a beautiful beverage for this cold weather. It's like something you get at Starbucks, but it's better because there's rum inside of it. So how much better can you get than warming up with a hot drink that has rum in it?
So what I want to ask you, you know, the cold months and all that, and you're trying to, I think, entice us with some of these dishes. This is a chance for people to try out some new restaurants, but it's also, conversely, a chance for some restaurants to sort of make their mark, carve out some new business.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's a great opportunity for people to explore and, you know, get some restaurants, and there have been a few really great openings. We just talked about Floor 2 downtown, or The Whale, which is at the District Hotel, has amazing seafood, so if that's an option you want to go for.
And an amazing bar scene, too.
and a really terrific bar scene.
Russell, what are some new places Pittsburghers or even visitors should be excited about in 2018?
So one place that just opened, it's really tiny and cozy, perfect for a winter night. It's called Piazza Tallarico, and it's in Lawrenceville. I think there are fewer than 20 seats there, and they really want it to be inspired by feeling as if you're at a Sunday dinner, if you're at grandma's house, if you have Italian heritage, you probably recognize this this concept. But they have wonderful pastas, and I think carbs are excellent for warming up on a cold night.
Okay. Anybody else?
Yeah, I'm all for carbs. We're on a cold night. Agreed. And we've got this, there's a bunch of two Detroit-style pizza places right now in Pittsburgh. So there's Ironborn at Smallman Galley.
Awesome.
Which is, and if you're not familiar with Detroit-style pizza, it's basically a pizza baked in a rectangular pan that's angled. And then the cheese, there's cheese on the outside, which, you know, the corner of the macaroni and cheese that everyone fights for. It's basically a pizza with, like, that kind of crust on the outside.
You're making us all hungry.
I know. I know. It's a tough time for it.
It's so good. It is just so good, really.
And definitely bring a friend, because that is a dense meal. I think maybe 3 slices is all I can ever eat, but it's so good.
Oh, you are such an amateur. I could eat the whole thing. So.
All right.
Marathon runner.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA, and we're talking about the cold weather, opportunities to do some things indoors, whether it's exploring the restaurant scene or other activities. And so I want to ask you, what do each of you like to do on a cold day? oh, I'm getting some looks. And they're all looking, and both Rosalind. You're being looked at, Hal.
I mean, like I said, I mean, cooking is such a great thing to do. It's a great thing to do with friends. I think it's a great opportunity to catch up on books that you want to read. And just, you know, get cozy. I like the cold, so I'm wearing long johns right now. And today's a little bit cold to go on a walk, but I think if it's a little bit warmer to, you know, bundle up and go on a walk with the fresh air, I think it's really nice, actually.
Yeah, I mean, I share Hal's affinity for the cold. I like to be outside, but and I love to be inside, and I'm always cooking. So, and of course, curling up on the couch with a good book is always an option, or a movie. Like last night, I watched Beauty and the Beast. How about that?
There we are, an old favorite.
An old favorite, so.
All right, Rosalind, we've already determined you don't like the cold.
That's right.
So what do you like to do when it is cold?
Well, that's why I was looking at my fellow speakers here, because it may not be too exciting, but if it's really cold out, you can most likely find me in my house with a good book, catching up on some reads for book club, usually with my cat on my lap if she's calm enough. And I'm also thinking of maybe venturing out into the cold so that I can go to Phipps for the last weekend of the Holiday Magic flower show.
Yeah, that just seeing those flowers, that'll warm you
Absolutely.
Up a little bit, even though it's the winter flower show, or used to be called that.
It's always spring in there.
Yeah, exactly. So speaking of running,
right.
And you mentioned earlier, Gretchen, that about the marathon pre- the first event, shall we say, being delayed a day till Sunday. Are there any unique health effects in exercising in these really cold terms? You wrote about it this week for the Post-Gazette.
Right. Well, people think that if you are outside exercising in extremely cold weather, you're going to hurt your lungs, but it's really just not true. If you are an otherwise healthy adult, you're going to be fine. There's no underlying conditions. The concern really is more frostbite. So it's all about making sure that you're properly attired and that you're layering your clothing and you're wearing warm socks and you're keeping your ears covered and you're wearing mittens so your fingers are touching to stay warm. So there's not really any health issue out there, you know, other than just make sure you stay warm.
What about warm up? Longer time to warm up?
Yeah, and I mean, that also could be an issue because, you know, when it's this cold outside, you just want to get going. You don't want to stand around and wait for the start. So your body might not be warmed up as properly, so there's more of a risk of you maybe pulling something. Oftentimes when it's cold out, it's also snowy or icy. You have to worry about slipping and falling. And if you fall and hurt something, man, then your whole season could be shot. So you just have to dress warmly, be, you know, aware of where you're running, you know, if you're on the sidewalk or the street. But I've run many, many times in weather that it's been 0 degrees.
So the maybe the biggest challenge is making sure that you're not slipping on ice.
Right. Well,
for as far
the biggest
as the
challenge would be getting yourself out of bed in the morning when you're nice and warm and you know that it's going to be so cold out there. So that for me is just the biggest challenge. But once you get, you know, out there, it's runners are hardy people and Pittsburghers are hardy people. So
Gretchen, are you preparing for the marathon?
I'm not preparing for the marathon this year. I'm going to be doing a race in D.C., the Cherry Blossom. So and probably just the relay for the marathon because I have 3 children all graduating in 3 successive weeks from college, so I will be out of town.
Okay, I want to ask this next question. I expect very different perspectives from you. So the cold weather, the potential impact on running or getting out and exercising, could this affect New Year's resolutions? I'm going to get more exercise. I'm going to be out and moving more about. Especially when Hal and Rosalind have been talking about especially eating a lot and food. So how does the cold weather affect those New Year's resolutions, Rosalind?
Well, Hal and I are always talking about food, basically.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Well, you do report on it, let's face it.
But I would have to recommend if folks don't want to get outside to work out, ClassPass recently came to Pittsburgh. If you're not familiar with this, it's an app you can get on your phone, and you can sign up to get a certain number of classes per month. You can try out different studios, everything from yoga to bar classes, cycling classes, so you can stay indoors and still get a really good workout.
Okay. All right, Hal, you've been talking a lot of good food here and making me hungry. So how does that deal with that New Year's resolution question?
Yeah, I mean, so far so good for me with my New Year's resolution of exercising more. I went swimming the other night at the gym. Last night I went to the gym and worked out, but then it was so cold and I wanted some comfort that I did go to Pizza Talio and get a and get a pizza afterward. So,
well, that negated all that exercise.
I'd say it balanced it. Okay. Is, you know?
I don't know. I'm going to guess that you're either the type of person who keeps your resolutions or you're the type of person who you don't. So we've all been at the gym in January where there's tons and tons of people. And, you know, pretty much by mid-February, a lot of those people are gone. So I don't know. Getting yourself out the front door is you know, the biggest thing.
Okay. Rosalind, the incline tends to be sort of keep a pulse on Pittsburgh's social media presence. I have noticed a few or more than a few beach posts, wishful thinking for warmer weather, perhaps. Anything else you're seeing online regarding social media and the cold?
Yes, we, I think, are longing for warm weather. Our office on Nova Place on the north side looks out to the skyline, which is really beautiful, but has been quite blustery recently. So I think we're dreaming a little bit about warm weather. Tonight we're all going, our staff is hosting a trivia night. So we are going to be keeping warm with trivia. We do have a bunch of Pittsburgh winter related questions. So if you want to join us tonight, we'll be at 8 o'clock starting at East End Brewery in the Strip District. Get ready to test your Pittsburgh knowledge and general knowledge. No beach questions, though.
Okay. Hal and Gretchen, other than either going to the beach or wishing you were at the beach, have you talked to people and other ways they're coping with the cold?
I think people are just hunkering down, and it's really only going to be tomorrow that's going to be super duper cold because it's going to be back up in the 20s on Sunday, and you know what? You live in Pittsburgh. It's winter. It's cold.
That's the, like when the bar is, it's going to be in the 20s. You know, it's really cold right now.
Seriously.
All right. So I am much older than all of you. So I ask this question. Are we getting wimpier when it comes to the cold? You know, yeah, it's cold out, but as you said, Gretchen, it's Pittsburgh. It's cold. It's supposed to be cold
during
the winter.
It's sunny today. It's beautiful out there, you know?
You know, for me, that is really the thing, though, is when it's a day like this, when it's, like, cold, but it's sunny. Even, you know, you can go outside, or even if you're sitting inside, you can appreciate what's happening, and you can appreciate the season. And, you know, that makes it fine, because in not too long, it's going to be spring, it's going to be summer, and, you know, we're going to be on here talking about what to do on a too-hot day and how to cool down.
Okay, Rosalind?
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. I'm pretty wimpy about this whole cold thing.
Okay. Well,
but remember, days are getting longer.
That's right.
We're coming out of the tunnel.
Getting a little brighter each day.
Okay. So my final question to you, we have just a minute left. What will you be covering, reporting, indoors, perhaps? What do you think? What's coming up on, dare I say, pun intended, your plates?
Well, I've got a story coming out in the February issue about bartenders who have made a career bartending and who've been doing it for more than 30 years. So looking at the neighborhood bars, people that have really made a career out of it, which I think is really exciting and a really interesting thing to hear all the stories, both from the bartenders and hear all the stories that they've heard over the years.
And quickly, Gretchen, what's it coming up?
You know,
I
write a lot for the Post-Gazette's food section, so I'm just going to be doing the usual, testing recipes, looking at cookbooks. I am working on a story that'll run in another week on a really good winter dish, cassoulet, for people to try out if they, you know, are feeling like something hearty.
And very briefly, Rosalind, what are you and the Incline working on?
I can't wait to read both of those things, first of all. But secondly, I'm working on a piece about some winter wonderland activities you can do a little further out from Pittsburgh if you're up for a drive toward the Laurel Highlands. So stay tuned.
All right. Rosalind Culligan's a culture writer for the Incline. Gretchen McKay writes for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. And Hal B. Klein covers restaurants and the food scene for Pittsburgh Magazine. Thanks to all of you.
Well, thank you.
Thanks.
What a pleasure.
Stay warm out there.
And for this week, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Our engineer is Tom Hurley. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next week, hope you have a good week of good news.